Well, it's a privilege to be here. I've delivered about six messages now from this spot, and I feel right at home. Our little team that came really appreciates Sedona hospitality to the Jeddah and to Pastor Fred. It's just been a wonderful time. So the picture on the screen comes from Croatia. And in 2007, I took my place inside the new cemetery facility in Croatia, in Osijek. It was sort of a dream because I was told I got to come and teach 2 weeks in the Psalms. The class is in English, and some of the students have Hebrew. So I just came with a great delight, took a team, and was very excited to be with these students. But the seminary picture is very different than the city picture. As we went into the city was filled with bullet holes. We had students from Macedonia, Albania, Romania, Croatia, Slovenia, Serbia. And though they were Christians, they didn't trust each other, and they didn't like each other. Many were lonely, isolated, poor, they didn't have any food to eat, and disillusioned. And so how were we going to make an impact on this little community and turn them into a family in 2 weeks? It was like trying to plant a vineyard in a field with centuries of rubble. But there was no one more acute that knew the feeling of rejection and the need to belong than Jesus. As Pastor Fred prayed, he was rejected by his family, his nation, and on the cross, ultimately his God. But it was out of rejection and that ache that he was going to create a new family and a new nation with no barriers and no divisions worldwide. And so our text, the context is that Jesus had just gone to the other side of the lake, to the Gentile side, which was a bit scary. And as you know, there was a great storm, and Jesus lay asleep on the boat. And the way that Jesus addressed the storm, it's obvious this was a demonic attack to drown that rabbi and put him in the depths of the sea. But when Jesus stands up and with a word stills the storm and brings great fear among the disciples, he gets to the other side of the lake, as you know, meets a Gerasene demoniac who has a legion of demons, Roman language, and Jesus drives the demons into the heart of the sea. It's called the Bay of Pigs, and never to rise again. And what Jesus did, it was the Jews' desire that the Romans go into the heart of the sea, that God deal with the Romans like he did the Egyptians. But Jesus doesn't put the Romans in the heart of the sea. He puts the devil into the depths of the sea. And this is the new Exodus that all of Israel's waiting for, and nobody gets it. So now Jesus returns to the other side of the lake. And when he returns, there's this large crowd that awaits him and presses in on him. And from the midst of the crowd emerges a leader of the Jewish community, a synagogue official. His name is Jairus, which means he will arouse or he will awaken. A little subtle preview to what's to come. And Jairus is filled with anxiety for his daughter. And at the first sight of Jesus, he casts all dignity aside and falling at Jesus' feet. And with grief-stricken urgency, he pleads for the life of his daughter. There's been enough evidence going around Galilee to convince this Jew that if Jesus would come and but lay his hands on her, she would be saved from her affliction. Now, the condition of the daughter is so critical that Mark records no verbal response from Jesus, only decisive immediate action. He went away with him. So they take off in tandem as if they're in an ambulance fixed on a rescue mission. And such a scene grips any parent who's been in similar circumstances. I've been there for two children, actually. And when the life of a child is threatened, your world instantly collapses. Your insides cave, and your resolve is fortified. You will do anything for your child. So what an amazing sight this must have been for the crowd to see the ruler of the synagogue falling down at the feet of a carpenter and entreating him for things a Jew would only entreat Israel's God at the temple. Who is this carpenter? So in the midst of this crowd, Jesus heads off. Multitudes are pressing on every side. In the midst of the crowd is another victim of circumstance, an unnamed woman. Now, see, Mark gives a very lengthy description of her, and that interrupts the journey, and he wants us to linger long over her condition. So here in that crowd was a woman who'd been crippled by a bleeding hemorrhage for 12 years. And in the process, she spent all her wealth searching for a cure, but her condition only grew worse, not to mention the agonizing humiliation at the hands of the physicians. So not only was she physically hampered and psychologically humiliated, but far worse, the cleanliness laws in Israel render her unclean as long as the condition lasted. Her bed was unclean. Her garments were unclean. Anything she sat on became unclean, and anyone with whom she had contact with would become unclean. Because she was unclean, she was cut off from all community and worship, 12 years of pain, humiliation, and isolation. So in our terms, she wouldn't have been to church since 2006. She risks her life coming into this crowd. If they were known she was there, she could have been killed. Now, I've never understood the power of uncleanness until I became attentive to stories of women who'd suffered sexual abuse. In our nation, that's 1 out of 4. And as I listened to them, I discovered it wasn't the life-threatening danger that lived to haunt them, but the shame of uncleanness that the violation left in its wake. A shame that seemed to wall them up in silence and seclusion, and then re-enter into the privacy of their locked souls unannounced, with no invitation, and relentlessly torment them day and night in the reenactment of their horror. In the women's retreat that we had, and hearing the testimonies of women, I have to say that every woman in that retreat was locked up in pain and had the freedom to come and articulate that. Now, Mark's graphic description draws us into the woman's story, evoking empathy for her condition. But if you look at it closely, suddenly her life becomes a mirror to all of Israel, and by implication, us. For her condition has been going on for 12 years, and the adjective Mark uses to describe her condition comes right out of the book of Isaiah to describe Israel's uncleanness that brought on her exile. Exact same words. All of us have become unclean, righteous deeds like a bloody garment. And there's no one who calls on your name who arouses himself to take hold of you. So in the story, it's Jairus who arouses himself, and it's the woman who's going to take hold of Jesus. Now, what's so intriguing about this woman is her faith. In the Old Testament, stand up, Pastor Fred. If I'm unclean, and I grab hold of your pastor, what happens? He becomes unclean. But now this is Jesus, sorry. He did have more hair than that, but. So now the unclean woman just touches the hem of his prayer shawl, and his holiness is so intensified that the holiness of Jesus makes the foulest unclean. Thank you, Jesus. Now that's faith that had never been had before. Jesus came to intensify holiness. Now, this has tremendous implications on how we live as Christians. I think so many Christians feel the world's going to infiltrate us, you know, and defile us. And so Christians make little holy huddles everywhere, Christian bowling alleys, and Christian this and Christian that. Instead, we're to go out in the world by twos and make everything unclean clean. So last night, our team, we had dinner at Elote. And right in the middle, it was 10 of us. You know what we did? We had communion. Told the waitress, get us the wine, get us the bread. And we took an hour to share that around that table. We were sanctifying that table, not to mention our waitress. That's the joy of being Christians. Okay, enough propaganda. Here we go. Now, as the woman touches his garment, she's immediately healed of her affliction. And at that moment, Jesus becomes aware that the power residing in him had gone out of him. So now he seeks her out, not to make the miracle known, but to perfect her imperfect faith. So Jesus doesn't want to help or heal someone without sealing the relationship with that person. And he's never too busy or in too great a hurry to deal with us, for our relationship with him is more important than solving the problems we bring to him. So he stops the ambulance. Now, I was in an ambulance once with my daughter. Now, think of this. We're on the way to Stanford Hospital. And so what if the ambulance driver sees a driver who's got a spare tire out and he stops the ambulance to take care of that person? How would you feel? So he stops. Who touched my garments? The disciples are dumbfounded. Everybody's touching you. And you say, who asked, who touched me? Well, many were touching him, but only one touch had faith. And how often Jesus has been in our midst, but we failed to reach out and take hold of him by faith. So now that her cover's gone and her deed is discovered, the woman is overcome with anxiety and fear. Imagine her trauma. Is the crowd going to turn and kill her? Is Jesus going to rebuke her? But Jesus' eyes has that look of acceptance and love that overcomes her fear and frees her to cast herself at his feet. And what does she do? She tells the whole truth. Now, this is the center line of the story. That's the most important line of the story. She holds nothing back, nothing of her affliction, nothing of her abuse, nothing of her uncleanness. 12 years of pain is now exposed, and with that confession, what happens to her? She becomes a member of the family. And what's her title? Daughter. Go in faith. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. You've been healed of your affliction. So the shame that once secluded and silenced her now vanishes like dew in the heat of day. Jesus is always doing this. He's always healing the outcast and then works to bring them back into the center of the community. And so one touch of faith has granted her salvation, shalom, and all the privileges that membership in God's family affords. So that's the woman. But while Jesus is sensitive to her situation, think of Jairus' anxiety. His daughter is 1 minute from eternity. So Jesus has just finished conversing with the woman when the messengers arrive, and it's the phone call you never want to get. So my wife and I both got married having a very rare enzyme deficiency. And there was only 4 cases of ours in the U.S., so we had a son, David Jonathan, born perfectly healthy, and his enzymes can't process ammonia, and 9 days, he's dead. We have the amniocentesis by the guy that invented it. We're pregnant again. The odds are good. It's 1 out of 4 chances of happening, 1 out of 16 twice in a row. I think it'll never happen again. The amniocentesis comes back. We have a healthy little girl. We change the wallpaper from blue to pink. Jessica Lynn is born. Precious. 3rd day, she gets sick. Emily holds her all night, knowing it's her last day with her daughter. She doesn't call me till the morning, and I get the phone call. And I'm in denial. So they send her to Stanford Hospital, they hook her all up, and I take a look at her once, and I'm overwhelmed with grief, and I go home. I call the next day, how's my daughter? The nurse just goes, oh, she expired. No one told me she was at the edge of death. I wasn't there. Hospital took care of the body. She's gone. The phone call you never want to have. That's how Jairus felt. So overhearing the question, why trouble the teacher anymore? Jesus encourages the synagogue official to be like that woman, to stop fearing, and the Greek text is better translated, continue to believe. Be like that woman. For just as the severity of her condition and the loss of hope in man to help is what thrust her face on Jesus, so now Jairus' destitute condition is what will encourage him to continue believing to overcome his fears. So at this point, Jesus separates from the crowds, taking only Jairus and the three disciples into the home. And there they find the home in an uproar, overrun with grief, emotion, and wailing. It was like the storm at sea. There's another storm going on. And Jesus comes in and with a word calms the sea of emotion with just a word. Why take a commotion? The little child has not died. She is alive, but is sleeping and will awake. But he hasn't even seen the girl. How can he give a diagnosis? And so they mock him. So he puts them out. He takes command of the situation, clears the house of anyone but her parents, and enters the room with the little girl, takes her by the hand, and says two words in Aramaic. He says, Talitha kum. Now, why do you think the gospel writers left the Aramaic in there? There's about three places in Scripture where we hear the exact words of Jesus in the original tongue. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me? And here, Talitha kum. Talitha kum is Aramaic, and it comes from Isaiah. And I'll tell you what it means. Well, it means little girl arise, but it comes from Isaiah. It's the poetic description of the Messianic king when he's going to save Israel out of exile. With his right arm, he will bring justice like God did to Egypt. And with his other arm, he will lift up the little lambs and carry them in his bosom, the talits. And Mark says that shepherd with its new creation is now here. And immediately the girl gets up, and guess what? We learn her age. What is it? 12. How many years was the woman have a hemorrhage? How many tribes are in Israel? What is this saying? This is the new Israel. This is the way God makes the new family. It's not through physical birth. It's out of brokenness and a touch of Jesus. So the home that was overcome with grief is now awash with awe, and Jesus commands the witnesses to secrecy, commands them to feed her before CNN gets there and all the news reporters. And that's the story. So what's the point? Well, Jesus came to offer a new creation. Not an overhaul, not a 12-step program, not reforming us, brand new creation. When David sinned with murder and adultery, his prayer to God was, you know what? I am a depraved sinner. Create in me a new heart. I can't be reformed. I need a new creation. I need you to speak like you did in Genesis 1 and bring light out of darkness and order out of chaos. Change me from within. David prays that. The prophets then take it as a promise for the new covenant, that God will bring a new creation when a child no longer dies at an early age, where the wolf lies down with the lamb. So the question is, how do we enter this new creation? And the answer is by faith. And that faith is born in Jairus and woman through the agonizing means of what? Delay. It's faith plus delay. For the woman, the delay was what? 12 years, spending everything she had. For Jairus, the delay was a few moments, but those moments seem like an eternity to a waiting father whose daughter is on the brink of death. So delay caused both the woman and Jairus to abandon hope in the world and cast themselves at the feet of Jesus as their high priest for a new creation. For Jairus, there was no hope left in the synagogue. For the woman, there wasn't any money left, nor a physician who'd not abused her. I'm thinking of our gymnastics doctor who abused all those women. I was a gymnast. I'm ashamed. And they finally, through that delay, got to give all their testimonies. They got a voice. This is what happens here. So the woman came to Jesus, trusting in his holiness that one touch would make her clean, and the laws which once excluded her are now obsolete. Jairus would need even more faith to follow Jesus, to have faith outside the grave for resurrection, if there was any hope of his daughter. That's how we enter the new creation. When you lose hope in the world to restore our lives, repair our despair, or cleanse our shame. At that critical hope, that's when faith is born. So Paul says, anyone is Christ. He goes, new creation, new creation, new creation. That's the first thing. But what else? Faith integrates people. So what's the result of the new creation? So delay not only integrates faith, but it's integrating people who were once painfully isolated from each other, and it puts them into a family. For our story ends not with three isolated individuals. What do you have? You have a father, a woman, and a child. What do we call that? A family, all around the number 12. Now, Jairus came to the woman, or to Jesus, for a daughter. But then Jesus interrupts the mission to deal with another daughter. And Jairus doesn't know it, but he needs that woman in his life to get his daughter back. He needs a relationship with her. Why? Because she has faith he doesn't have, and she's going to be a mirror to him of what he needs to get his daughter back. So the delay is to integrate these people into a family to heal his daughter. Now, did you know almost every leader in the Old Testament, when God calls someone to a great task, he uses a woman to be a mirror to him of the faith and the office he's going to need to perform his office? Do you know that? Hannah, her story and her poetry of having no voice, and she breathes out a lament, and then it's articulated, and then it's a thanksgiving, and then it's a praise. That shaped David to know how to do the Psalms. Moses, going to lead Israel out of Egypt, and he's going to put the blood on the doorpost. But how did he know to be serious about that? It's because he didn't circumcise his son, and the Lord tried to kill him. And who gets in the middle? His wife. Circumcised it, throws the circumcision down there, puts blood all over him, says, you made me the bridegroom of blood. That's a mirror to him. If you don't come under the blood, you'll die. Then go on and on and on. That's what's happening here. The woman trains the man to get faith. And it ends up in this wonderful new creation. And in this new creation, God gets his daughter back. Jairus gets his daughter back. And so we end up with this incredible new family. Now, it's interesting. When I lost my children, I then went to Romania under communism. And I'm thinking, how in the world can I connect to these people who have suffered? And so my friend Wendy says, you know what? Don't teach the text. You need to tell them your story about your kids first. So in telling the story about David and Jessica, the pathway opened up, and I fell in love with all these Romanians who were losing their lives right and left for the gospel. And all these kids in this little village of Simbatane were the age of the kids that I lost. And I adopted them into my heart. And instead of losing two children, I got a nation of kids through my kids. And in Croatia, I told everybody, you have to write your own psalm. And four of the students came up and they said, do we have to be honest in those poems? I said, well, yeah. They says, well, we don't like them. We don't want to share in front of them. I said, well, no poem, no grade. And so poetry night came, and they were terrified, and they all gathered in the room. And out comes the first poem. It was 1991 when the war started, I was 5 years old. This young girl was from Vukovar, and the Serbs were going to make Vukovar an example and turn Vukovar into Auschwitz and totally destroy it. So she's 5 years old, her home is bombed, her dad is shot. She opens up and is vulnerable. The poems go from 8 o'clock to midnight. They're all sharing. One gal shares she hid in the basement for 2 years. And when she came out, the Croatians put a gun to her head, said, "We're going to kill you because you didn't fight for us." The neighbor screamed, "She did fight for us, saved our life." So then, after the war, she marries a Croatian soldier. She has a little girl who's at the conference. And then she goes, "I don't really know who this guy is." She does research, found out he's already married. He's got girlfriends in all the towns. So she leaves him. And then he comes to get her. And she says, "I'm not going." He says, "Fine." A couple months later, he comes back, and he has a gift for the family. So she's sitting in here with a little girl, mama and papa. He pulls out a gift. It's a grenade. Pulls the pin, throws it in the living room. Dad jumps on the grenade, blows his legs off. And she goes, "My dad is alive, in constant pain. But I'm his legs, and I take him everywhere. And Jesus jumped on the grenade of my sin, and I'm his legs, and I take him everywhere." So this went on from 8 to 12. And I said, "Okay, good news, bad news. The bad news is we got to stay up longer. We're going to have communion, and you're going to serve each other. The good news is there's no paper. You all got an A. You did it." And we became a family. In 2 weeks, students that did not like each other, trust each other, generations of hatred, became a family by doing what that hemorrhaging woman did, becoming vulnerable. And you can turn any group intimate by taking a risk and telling your whole story. And that's what went on for these last 2 days with these women. Stories came out. Some women were in their 70s, hadn't told what it was like to have a mother hate them their whole lives. It was the most beautiful time of uniting what Jed's vision was, 20 different churches coming together. So this has been a real gift for us in our church, just to get people to tell their stories and write their own poems. And I live in a church of engineers in Silicon Valley who have no use for poetry, and so I'm trying to turn engineers into poets. And James actually wrote a song on this text. We were in Romania in 1988, and I'm going to have him sing it for you. It's called Talitha Kum.